Hi, I'm Susan Lewis. I sat down with composer Morris Wright and Philadelphia Orchestra principal timpanist Don Liuzzi, for whom Wright wrote his timpani concerto, Resounding Drums. Don first talked about the physical demands in playing the concerto.
Definitely, there's six drums that I'm surrounded by and a little rototom. And it does, I fortunately have a seat that swivels, so it assists my getting around a little bit, although I have lost 10 pounds in the last few weeks. So.
Well, how did this concerto come to be? Morris.
Well, Don and I have known each other a long time. And over the course of the years, he's played almost everything that I've written. And after each performance, we would talk about what another interesting thing would be to try to do. And so I forget which of us thought of it, but there was a notion that a timpani concerto would be an interesting project. And this goes back some years, and I've been thought about it for a very long time and spent some time looking at what I thought that would entail. In other words, what would it be like to listen to drums for 20 minutes or more than 20 minutes? And so the idea was that the form had to be full of contrast, that the three movements had not only to sound different tempos, but to try to accomplish totally different things. And so I worked on that, and then I started composing the piece, and I asked Don, well, should I think about how the range of this drum or the range of that drum? And he really got tired of that very quickly. He said, just write a piece, and then we'll worry about it later, about how to play it. And I don't know if he regrets that or not.
No, I think actually it was the right way to go, because as a timpanist, you have to map out your tuning scheme, because there's different pitches. Every drum has a range, and so it just... Like any composition, you work out your tuning scheme after it's written, and when you see it. So that's what happened. And there was very few changes, right? Just a couple of little, one or two moments were a little too unplayable. So.
Well, for a little bit of background, for people who have never seen timpani up close, they're kettle drums.
Yeah, it's a copper bowl, either round or semi-flat shape, and they're different sizes. There's a 32-inch, a 29, a 26, 24, 23, and then a piccolo 20-inch drum. We're even using a little rototom, which is actually not really a timpani. It's a rotational drum that changes pitches. There's one spot where I only have 2 feet, so I had to add a little tom-tom to kind of play the passage that he wrote, because it was a really important kind of jazzy flat third that I didn't want to miss. So you do your tuning scheme based upon those drums, and you know the ranges, and you figure out. So you're writing in the music, not only when to tune, when to move your feet between the six drums.
And your feet adjust the tension on
the
top.
The pedals that I have are changing the tension, changing the pitch.
So what is the range total?
Well, this is where we probably broke some new ground, and hopefully not any drums, but the range of, if you look in any orchestration book, the range of the timpani is just about an octave, a little bit more, and we're more than two octaves in this piece, from almost to middle C all the way down to the very lowest note of the bassoon, so a very large range.
Wow. Well, I was going to ask you if you wanted to simply showcase what the timpani can do, because even though we hear the timpani in other pieces, it's in the back and it's sometimes color and accent, or you wanted to extend what the timpani could do.
Well, I think extension was very much in my mind because the timpani in the orchestra, there's a traditional role in classical orchestral writing where they really double the trumpets and provide certain articulations at structural moments in the piece. Then it becomes more expressive as history goes on. And finally, with composers like Bartok, the timpani has a much more prominent melodic role. And I wanted to put it totally in the melodic camp for at least part of the piece. A lot of it is about drumming and refers to things that drums do well. But a lot of it is also about singing and melody, which is, I think, unusual for the timpani.
Could you talk in particular about the different movements? Because they each evoke different kinds of imagery. And what were you trying to do?
Well, sure. The first one is the slow movement. So we thought we'd begin the piece with the slow movement and a quiet movement. And the way that movement works, it's titled Leviathan. And my wife is certain it depicts a whale, but there's more to it than just the whale side of it. The idea, especially in the stories of sailors who are on ships of the sea, is the fear that even though the sea is calm and beautiful and the sun is shining, that down beneath them, there's some force that could rise up at any time and destroy them. In my view of the piece, I'm thinking of it less as a picture of a ship on a sea with a fish under it, and more of this as metaphor for our own emotional states, where we always have fears to confront and deep, dark things that are under. It also plays off the notion that the way the timpani's overtones are spaced, it really projects a note that's a little bit lower than is sounding at any one time. There's sort of an oral illusion with timpani sound. Second movement is totally different. It's a history lesson. It's about how the timpani came to Europe. And it turned out that it came in 1529 when the Turks first attacked Vienna. The timpani were battle instruments. The Turks brought them in. There was a pitched battle in Vienna. And the Turks were routed. They ran away and left behind two very important things for European culture. One were timpani and other percussion instruments, and also coffee, which came at the same time. You imagine Vienna without coffee or timpani, as you have to thank the Turks for having the nerve to try to take it over. The last movement kind of moves back from all of the didactic stuff of the second movement with its depictions, and is really much more just a celebration of drumming. You think of drums as dancing instruments. These are called singing drums because it's going to be a dance in which the drums always have a melody. So it has the more dance-like character of the three.
And are the three connected in any way?
Well, gosh, I hope so. thank you for asking that question. The tonal scheme is similar, but the techniques are different. The second movement has quotations. The last movement is based on rhythm, but the connection is always some motivic ideas that I had that worked together. There are certain intervals that are reflected over and over.
Yeah, a minor third. In fact, that's a quote of Janáček's Sinfonietta that really comes through very clearly in the last movement. But even in the first movement, it opens with a minor third. It's kind of a thematic interval kind of throughout the piece.
Right. And you even hear it in the second movement. There's a quote from an old 16th century tune, bum, bum, ba-dum. So it begins the same song, even in the quote, it's there. So a lot of it is lined that way. One of the reasons a minor third is such a good interval is it's inside the sweet range of one set of drums. So the player can move from note to note and get this nice melodic sound without having the drum sound strained either high or low.
Well, I noticed, Don, you were very, very busy. And not just playing, but changing mallets and tuning.
Changing pitches, yeah.
So normally, during a normal performance of another piece where you're in the back, you're doing all those things. You're tuning, you're changing mallets. What is it like when you're right up front, both musically and visually? Is it logistically more complicated?
Well, there's the issue of when you're up front. I've played a few concertos before, the Kraft and Siegfried Matthus, but both those, I performed those kind of on a platform halfway back into the orchestra, really. It was really more of a sectional being with the percussion section in those concerto situations. But so being up front, I have played another concerto kind of close up front, the Bartók concerto for two pianos, two percussion. So that's up front. So when you're up front, it's a totally different situation with timing. You have to actually, and Yannick has been reminding me of this, just sit back in the time. Don't push like you are in the back. When you're in the back, you have to anticipate much more. There's a distance of sometimes 30 to 40 feet or more. In the academy, it was like 60 feet. I mean, it was a football field away, but Kimmel is a little shallower, but there still isn't. You have to anticipate when you're in the back. And if you do that up front, you're going to beat the rest of the band to the punch, to the beat. And so I'm having to kind of still learn how to relax the time as a soloist.
And the sound of the orchestra is different.
Oh, yeah. No, that's great. I mean, orchestra is so fabulous. It's just a joy to hear it in different places. I mean, when you're back, I hear it completely differently. You're right. I'm just hearing the effect of the hall bouncing back to me, which is another reason you can't really listen to the sound. You have to kind of anticipate and do more visual cues with the conductor. But up front, I'm hearing it and loving it. It's just it's a hoot. It's great.
Well, and I understand there's one section in particular where you play a melody in one hand and the rhythm in the other hand.
Yeah, that's in the cadenza. Actually, the cadenza is brilliant. I got to tell you, Morris, I love the cadenza. It's really idiomatically written, but also plenty challenging. He's got a little ostinato in the left hand, bum 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 bum. Then I got a melody going on bum 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 bum. You know, because so it's, and that's not atypical, but it's very creatively composed, and so I'm enjoying it.
One of the I just want to say one of the impressive things about Don's technique that, again, if you're not careful, you'll miss these things. But he's tuning the drums for notes that are coming up, not for the notes, obviously, that are going by. So the orchestra may be playing a very prominent F, and Don has to tune an F sharp. Or the orchestra may be playing really loud in a key that's unrelated to anything that he has coming up. But he still has to set the drums and test them and do it very quickly. So it's a testimony to his technique, as you just heard. He can sing the multiple rhythms in the cadenza. And the fact that he really can sing the whole piece through is the reason that it works, because I think it's very challenging, more challenging than it looks. I'd be very curious to see who tries it next.
I'll just say, good luck. Go for it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you about the piece, and it's been wonderful to hear the piece. I love the drums. There are a lot of composers who feel that they should have a more prominent place in the orchestra. Percy Grainger would have introduced a fourth section that was the same size as the rest of, as a wind, brass section or woodwind section of just all sorts of drums. And we're not there yet, but it's an awful lot of fun to write for percussion.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.